The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. I am here with the winner of the CAPS Best Ontario Sommelier Competition of 2022 and SOM at Don Alfonso. It is Justin Madol. Justin, thank you so much for being a part of this.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
And we are here at just gorgeous Casa Loma. It's been ages since I've been here. I feel like I'm in some old French chateau at this place.
Yeah, it's an incredible location. Definitely loved working here in the time between moving Don Alfonso around. It's a great place to be. Just beautiful location.
Well, actually, it seems that's a constant with you, because I had people that listen to this podcast had James on from Don Alfonso. It's just a gorgeous location. But I want to start here because I want to talk about wine competitions, studying them, doing them, and also just your quest right now to get your master sommelier and just the work that goes into that. But what is the day before and the morning of for you? What was it for you going into the CAPS Best Ontario SOM competition?
Yeah, I think, when you're approaching a competition situation, I think it's really important that, you're taking care of yourself physically, that you're eating right, that you're sleeping right, that you're getting yourself in a frame of mind where you're ready to compete. So I did, the day before, some light review, but mostly just relaxed, ate a good meal, made sure I got enough sleep. And then the day before, I do a lot of, vocal warm-ups, a lot of physical warm-ups to get the body loose, make sure that, my mind feels nimble. Tasted a couple wines just to kind of calibrate the palate in case there's any blind tasting that comes up, but mostly just trying to get myself, in a headspace where I picture myself being successful.
That sounds like when people in theater, people in stand-up, maybe even musicians before live, like what your day of and the lead-up to it sounds like what you would do if you were on Broadway.
Yeah, 100%. Well, I mean, that's definitely a journey that I've been on. I did undergrad studies in cultural anthropology and media communication, but from that I actually went into performance side of things, and I'd worked as a photographer and did a little bit of videography, but was fortunate enough that I applied and auditioned for the National Theatre School of Canada, a conservatory classic trained acting program in Montreal, and I spent 3 years studying classical acting, and surprisingly enough, that's a through line for me in kind of everything I do is storytelling. But certainly there's a lot of similarities, and I don't think it's kind of by coincidence that, people in the performance industry take service jobs as side jobs and are very successful at it, because ultimately that's what you're doing. It is a bit of a performance, and it certainly has those same kind of similar elements. So I carry that work with me. And that work too, I think really is life skill. Just self-reflection, self-introspection, and honoring, where you're at in terms of, your headspace and your anxiety and things like that, and using techniques to be able to bring yourself back to a place where, again, you're going to picture yourself being successful and approach everything confidently.
That's interesting. My main job is working in sports media. I host a radio show. I was a theater major as well. I was the only guy That's practicing cool. for Hamlet while wearing a Phil Simms jersey, which kind of dates me a little bit, a former New York Giants quarterback. Awesome. Now we'll get into the competition. How much is your theater training? How much has that helped you over the years? Because you mentioned being a storyteller. It's also one of the common through lines whenever I talk to anyone in service. Selling wine isn't about acidity. It's about story, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, wine is about story from every angle. I mean, the story of, how it's made, the story of the place where it's made, the history of the place, the history of wine and culture, and then, of course, the story of the wine on the night in the moment when you're opening it with the guests and their story of the evening, whether it's a birthday or anniversary. But I think the one thing that really kind of, again, resonates with me and kind of connects those two types of work is presence, being present at the table and being present with your guests. Is something that you often see in the theater world, of course, but it's just as equally important when you're in the hospitality industry. You've got to arrive at a table and be present with people, and be engaged in the moment that they're having and amplify it and elevate it. So yeah,
it's like improv as well. Yeah, it's active sure. listening. It's yes and. It's not blocking. Also, it's in the comedy world. Everyone always likes the recall, the callback. You remember something that they said as you were pouring, you know, as you were pouring sparkling, and you can come back to you when, you know, you're talking to them about the red they're about to have with their roast beef.
100%. Yeah, 100%.
Okay, let's go to the competition for a second. How was it? I mean, obviously you won. Again, congrats. You were going up against some pretty damn good wine people. The judges are some legendary people in the biz. But take me through it. Like for people that are listening, they've never seen a wine competition, what are some of the things you have to master?
Yeah, so, I mean, first off, it was kind of an interesting thing to have to go first in the competition. Not saying it was good or bad, it was just a thing. We kind of all just drew our names out of a hat, and I happened to be the first one to go. You know, typically the competitions will focus on a couple different things, you know, the three main elements being theory, service, or what we might call practical, and then blind tasting ability. Those are kind of the real three things that you'll see most often in exam situations, but certainly in competition situations as well. So, you know, with the best Ontario sommelier competition, we had two service tables. One was sparkling, one was decanting service. In between, there were some rapid fire slides of images where you would have 5 seconds to identify what was on that slide, what they wanted you to identify there. There were some theory elements in terms of, you know, food pairing and, you know, drawing from different Canadian regions. And then quick blind tasting in between for three sparkling wines with some very kind of specific criteria in terms of sweetness levels and production method and lees aging. As I mentioned, yeah, the two practical tables, both sparkling and decanting, which includes small amounts of theory as well that are, you know.
What do they throw at you? Do you remember any of the specific?
Of course I do.
What were the questions?
I missed one on my first sparkling table. So the first one was, you know, asking for an English style ale, and then immediately, you know, refusing the first suggestion that you give them, and then looking for a second one. And that was certainly something that tripped me up. They asked a little bit about, you know, sparkling wine in England, which is, you know, definitely an emerging region in terms of traditional method sparkling. On the decanting table, it was more kind of some geography questions. You know, where is Margaret River in Australia? You know, where does this Cabernet come from? What was this vintage like? Is it a good vintage? So those are typical questions that you'd probably see in a service situation. You know, that's something that a guest might ask you is, hey, you know, I'm looking between the 2001 and the 2004. Like, can you tell me the difference? Tell me which one's better and why. Or I don't know, I don't recognize this label place. You know, where's this wine from? You know, those are typical theory questions that you'd get for sure.
Was there one slide you were really happy that you nailed?
Yeah.
And is there one you're angry that you missed?
Yeah, for sure. So, yeah, absolutely. So the one that I was really kind of happy that I got was a picture of Cheval Blanc in Saint-Emilion, because we tend to think of Bordeaux as being these super classic, you know, old country chateau with all this grandeur and splendor. But Cheval Blanc is actually really modern in terms of its architecture. And I think I was the only one that actually correctly identified it, because, you know, it looks much more like something you'd see in the New World in Napa or in South America. But I was happy with that one. And then the one that I really, you know, was upset about was that I didn't recognize Anne Sperling, who's a, you know, a really prolific Canadian winemaker, both here in Ontario and in BC. And
former guest on this podcast, Anne Sperling. Yes.
Yeah. So I was a little disappointed in myself for not recognizing that photo. I mean, knowing who she is, but I guess never having gone down the rabbit hole far enough to see a picture. So that was one that I was a little bit bummed out. But
and then the blind was strictly sparkling.
All sparklings this time. Yeah.
And what was the because I know, like, when you take exams for the Quartermaster Sommelier or even on the WSET, the annoying thing is they never tell you what it was. You know, they did. But for this, I imagine afterwards there was a reveal, because this is a competition for the people watching.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So
what was it?
I mean, so the three sparklings, I was close. I mean, I put them in the right order, at least for lees aging. But there was a Charmant method sparkling wine, which was extra dry, which was 12 grams per liter or more in terms of the sugar. And then the second wine was actually Drapier Champagne with about 24 months on lees. And then the last one was a Recoredo Cava which I think had 5 years on Lee's, and I think I said something along the lines of 36 months. So I think I had them in the right order for Lee's, but they were, it was tricky. It was tricky parameters. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not like you're getting, you know, Bordeaux Chianti and then some New Zealand Pinot. I mean, you're getting, I mean, actually, let's go there for a second. We'll get back to the competition, but for someone like yourself who has your advanced level for the court and you're studying right now for the diploma, for the master level, excuse me, I'm always curious about the war stories, the blind taste war stories. Do you have ones you are most proud of? And on the other end, wait a minute, I called what?
Yeah. I mean, we when I was leading up to the advance, we had a pretty good study group at the time. You know, there was three or four of us that were approaching the advanced exam, and we took a bit of a different angle at it. Normally, when you're going through the Court of Master Sommeliers, you know, you've got about, say, 40, 50 classic wines that you should be able to identify based on, you know, the structure and the flavor profiles. And that's kind of, I think, you know, when a lot of people are leading up to an exam, that's kind of all they tend to taste is testable examples. And we took a different approach to it. We said, you know, we'll bring in anything from anywhere, whether it's testable or not, and we should just be able to describe the wine accurately in terms of, you know, acid level and structure and alcohol. And the only kind of clue we would give the group would be, you know, this is a testable wine or it's not a testable wine. And that would give you the kind of where to kind of look at it. And I remember, you know, we had a couple brought in, and I, strangely enough, was able to identify, you know, German Pinot and Merlot from Okanagan Valley, which were a little bit of a Hail Mary on my part, but what got the wines right. And I was just like, wow, you know, like, it's like when you taste something and you kind of just, you know, identify the structure properly and then think about it and say, you know, where does this fit in terms of what I've learned and what I've studied? And you know what, that's what it could be. And so, like, those two, I was just like, wow, like, that was a lot of fun. And then one that I still think about often to this day. I mean, it's like, it's crazy. And again, it was one of these things where, you know, someone brings in a wine and we're a little bit crazy too. I mean, we go out and buy wines that we probably have no business buying for this type of stuff, but we do it anyway. And anyway, someone had brought in this wine and, you know, I'm tasting it and I'm like, geez, you know, like I get a lot of, it feels like it's got Bordeaux kind of sensibility to it. And I'm tasting it. And I'm like, oh, you know, the alcohol is probably, you know, medium plus here. I'm thinking 13.5, 14%, you know, and so I'm okay. I think this is, you know, this is left bank. This is, you know, St. Julian. But I think it's old, you know, it's probably 96 or 98. And anyway, you know, another guy's tasting with me. He's like, yeah, no, I think it's Bordeaux, but I'm going to put it on the right bank, you know, and we're like, okay, whatever. Let's take a look at what it is. And it was a 1990 Quintarelli Amarone with 16.5% alcohol.
Oh.
And I was like, wow. Like, not only did I not put that wine in the right place, like, how could I miss, you know, an alcohol level so high and call it medium plus? But I think, you know, looking back at it, I think it just speaks to the quality of the wine and the winemaker, that he's able to knit together a wine that can hold a structure like that and still have an element of elegance and not make it feel, you know, over extracted or heavy on your palate. So
you weren't calling a recent vintage $45 bottle of Amarone. I mean, you're talking Quintarelli. That's a lot of age on. You know what? Yeah. I take back that groan I gave about 12 seconds ago. I'm taking that back. that is a legitimate. You know what? I think that one's legitimate. I mean, or at the very least, an understandable miscall. So what was the celebration like afterwards, after you won?
Oh, it was great. I mean, like, it really just felt like a team win, to be honest. Like, all the guys that I was there with, competing with, like, I know them all really well. You know, I study with Christian, I've studied with Christoph, I work with Nathan. So, you know, seeing those guys, it really just felt like a win for all of us just being there and seeing that, like, you know, the hard work that we've put in is is so great. So, I mean, just, you know, having a glass of wine with those guys after was the best celebration I could have. And then just kind of, you know, going home and having a couple more. that was kind of the night. And then celebrating with my beautiful partner Melissa, you know, that was probably the best one of the best moments. It's been a really long year with a lot of study, and finally seeing some kind of some reward on that has been really nice. It's been really nice.
That kind of goes to one place I wanted to talk about is, what do people not know about the amount of time, energy, and money that goes into the journey you are on right now? And I should tell the people listening, you kind of shook your head at a pained expression.
Yeah, it's, I think you've got to be a little bit nuts to kind of try to do this at the highest level and go for that master certification, you've got to have just an insane kind of compulsive obsession with not only wine, but, you know, challenging yourself and wanting to win. I think that a lot of the reason that a lot of us do it is that we do have this kind of competitive nature to us, you know, we want to see ourselves at the top and want to see that success. So, but I mean, in terms of the preparation, it's absolutely extreme. I mean, I can't really stress it enough. And again, it just, people that don't know it are going to think I'm crazy. But I mean, when I was approaching the master theory, you know, I was still managing Don Alfonso at that time as the assistant general manager and had put in a lot of work in terms of moving it around. And I had to leave that position entirely. And in fact, I took full 3 months off, full-time study. You know, I'd put away a little bit of savings to make sure that I could, you know, not have to you know, work basically for that time. And I studied full-time. I was putting in 50, 60 hours a week, different study. And it's not just, you know, you're not just sitting down and reading and making flashcards. You've got to really, again, there's got to be a strategy to it. You've got to take a step back and say, okay, like, you know, how am I going to organize myself? How do I study? You know, how do I study best? What works for me and what doesn't? And that's just as important as the actual knowledge itself, is understanding, you know, how you retain knowledge and what works best for you. But yeah, I mean, I went at it, and I'm not saying that's the right or the wrong way, but I went at it in a very extreme way and put just so much effort into it. And I'll say one of the final things I realized, and I think this was the difference between, you know, my first attempt at master theory unsuccessful and my second attempt being successful, was that on my first attempt, I had kind of done it in a vacuum. I had really kind of approached it, and I was doing pretty much all the study on my own, outside of blind tasting. But on the second attempt, you know, I had got that, you know, the wisdom from one of the masters that was giving me feedback on my theory. And he said, you know, well, what's your study group? And I said, well, I don't really have one. He said, you will not succeed at this if you don't have a group. If you don't have other people that are studying with you at the same intensity, going for the same goal at the same time, you will not get through this exam. And that was the big thing that, you know, switched for me, was having that group around me that was just as crazy as me, that, you know, we're meeting twice a week and having more minds on the same regions and the same problems and the same things. Like, they bring out different stories and stuff just starts to resonate and click, and the way that we pushed each other, again, it was I think that's what really made the difference on the second attempt, was just having that support group around you and people that are moving at the same pace. And then in terms of money, I mean, I don't really want to talk about that.
We don't have to. It's, yeah, like, no, I know.
The amount of wine is crazy.
Listen, when someone in your group's bringing a 1990 Quintarelli for shits and giggles, I'm already getting it. I've been in my own tasting group, so I mean, I understand, but obviously on a far, far less level. By the way, congratulations on passing the diploma level theory. Okay, I'm going to hold the theory question for a second. I want to go back. Friends, family, your partner.
Yeah.
Did they, at what point did they realize, holy cow, the amount of, like, did any of them realize just what the path you were going, what it was going to require?
Yeah. Well, like, you know, my partner Melissa has been with me since the beginning. From, like, she's watched me go through this entire journey, right from the introductory level course with the CMS, leading all the way up to master theory. You know, and she's come with me on almost every trip when we go to the exam as you know, emotional support, basically, because it's a ton of pressure and a ton of anxiety that you face when you're going into an exam situation that you don't normally get in your day-to-day service. So, you know, I think she saw it early on that I was really going to go for this, and that I was really serious about it and how much it meant to me. And, you know, she kind of just got on board with it right away and was so supportive. And then, I mean, like, I think when she saw, you know, once she saw the piles of flashcards piling up on the dining room table and
the maps,
books and everything, I mean, I don't think we had a dinner at the dining room table for 6 months because it just had so much wine stuff on it. You know, she kind of realized that it was at that level. And, you know, my parents are back home in Newfoundland, and they've been so supportive of everything I've done, you know, in my entire life. And they can see, you know, how much passion I have for this. And they're so happy that, you know, that I've, that the work that I've put in is starting to kind of show itself. And, you know, that's like one of the best things, is just, you know, having them back me on this and support me and believe in me when I'm going to do these things. It's if you don't have that, you can't do this. It's impossible.
Yeah. It's the infrastructure required, as, you know, especially for yourself. You have your advanced, you've got one third of your diploma, You're Sam at a restaurant like Don Alfonso. So it, and you know, you win the recent competition. It's good that some of the fruits of your labor are paying off, because I imagine that helps you when you're sitting there and, you know, you're studying vintage charts, because at the very least you've seen tangible results from the nutty amount of work that you put into this. Is there, and I'll say on the front end, wine teaches humility more than almost anything else. Is there one region that you feel really great about? And is there one where it just, it doesn't click to the level that that you would want it to?
Yeah, I mean, that's a tough question. Like, I'm a person that believes that every bottle of wine has a place on a table at some point, at every quality level, and every winemaking style, and every grape in every region. You know, you can find a place, and that's the humility in it. It's like, you can never look at a bottle of wine and say, oh, you know what, I don't think I'm ever going to serve that, you know, and it doesn't do anybody any service in that way.
I mean, knowledge. Not your own personal feelings, like wines from this area are trash. I mean, like, that your own knowledge level. Like, if the exam it's on Oregon, you're like, I got this. But if it's but if it's on Greece, shit.
Yeah, for me, Burgundy is probably my strong suit. That's where I spend a lot of time, and I spent a lot of money on those wines, and I love those wines. Like, those wines are, I think, some of the most exciting wines in the world, and I just spent a lot of time there just looking at different crews and how they drink and the styles. And so, like, I'm very confident with that. It's not to say I know everything about it, but I'm very confident navigating Burgundy because I've had so much personal experience with it. And then, you know, something that continues to plague me is just, it's German wine. You know, outside of the Mosel, you're looking at places like Ahr and Baden and, you know, Middle Mosel and Nahe and Pfalz and all those places. And there's so many different crews and vineyards, and they all have big German names, and you know, they're it's hard for me to kind of keep it all clear in my head, and so I have to spend a lot of time going back and looking at that constantly. It's just a muscle that I have to keep exercising, or it atrophies, you know. And I think that's Germany for me has always been like that, and I think it's a problem area for a lot of Psalms, just again with the language and the similar sounding vineyards and things. But yeah, it's one of those places where I know it's a place where I just always have to put the work in, double than, you know, someone else might have to. So
how'd you get into wine?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting story. When I first moved to Toronto, you know, I was doing performance, and like many of us do, we take a side job, you know, at a restaurant. And, you know, I was looking for a job, and I had a buddy of mine who was like, hey, I'm working at this restaurant called Lee Restaurant on King Street, and, you know, people make pretty good money there. And I'm like, oh, cool. Like, do you think you can get me an interview? And he's like, yeah, sure. So I go down and I interview, and they're like, what experience do you have? I'm like, zero. I've never worked in a restaurant in my life. And they're like, okay, well, you know, everyone starts at the same place here anyway. It's the way we do things. You can start as a food runner and like a polisher, basically. And so I was like, okay, that sounds cool. And so, you know, I think part of my theater training was, a lot of what we do is like, you know, you just say yes and you commit to something. And that's kind of the mentality I have. And I didn't realize it at the time, but that is the mentality of a restaurant. It's yes, chef, and it's yes, it's yes, it's yes. And like, you always say yes and try to do more. And so, you know, I found myself kind of, you know, polishing glassware and running dishes at Lee Restaurant, which turns out was, you know, it's the very famous chef Suser Lee who runs that restaurant. And you know, I worked my way up through the ranks into becoming a server, serving tables. And I had always kind of enjoyed wine, and I didn't really understand it, but I had no problem buying, you know, a bottle of $20 Italian wine and enjoying it. So I just saw it as another way to increase the guest experience. So I started learning about the wines on the list, and, you know, I would go to the table and be super excited about something because I'd learned, like, you know, this interesting story about it, and I would tell it to the guests, and, you know, it just led to an increased experience for them, but also, you know, increasing the sales for the restaurant. And so I was given more and more opportunities in that way, and, you know, moved up into management, and then eventually was running the wine list there, and that's when, you know, I decided to start approaching, you know, the exams and such. It was funny because, you know, I'm a Newfoundlander, and when I was working there, there's people kept kind of saying to me, like, hey, you know, there's another Newfie here in the city that's really into wine. He's a sommelier. He used to work here. You know, you guys should really meet. And eventually he ended up coming back and doing a bit of a stint at Lee, as, you know, and in between. And I said, well, you know, what should I do? I'm really interested in wine. You know, should I go to George Brown? Should I do WSET? Should I take a couple courses? And he said, well, you know, if you got the money to spend on a course, he said, just go out and buy the wine and buy a couple books. He said, why can't you just do it yourself? And I said, okay, well, that's what I'll do. So I went out and I bought a bottle that, again, that had no business buying. He recommended, he said, you know, like, there's a bottle you should get. And it was a 1982 Chappelle Hermitage from Paul Jabulani, and I spent, you know, $350. And before that, I don't think I'd spent more than $30 on a wine, you know. And
wow, you
it was a leap of faith.
There was no dimmer switch. There was no dimmer switch from you.
No,
you didn't get yourself, you know, a nice Cote de Rhone. You went just straight there. Okay.
Yeah, it was crazy. Yeah, it was a crazy you know, opportunity. And I was interested in old wines because, you know, it just had, there's so much mystery to it, and it had such a, like, a prestige to it that I was like, you know, I really want to see what all the hype is about. You know, like, why did people age wines? You know, why have I seen this all, you know, in movies and literature and stuff? Yeah, I'm going to try it for myself. So, you know, and it was like one of those moments, you know, it's like, it's cliche to say it, but it was like the light bulb went on, you know.
Yep.
Like I tasted that wine. I said, man, this has got to be the best food item thing that I've ever had in my life. It's just so complex and magical and changing, and just, it's alive, you know. It had this presence to it, and that was it. That's kind of, I kind of just knew. I was like, wow, I'm just like, this is, I'm gonna do this, like, and that was it. So I mean, it was kind of a haphazard journey to get there. And then again, that competitive nature, just challenging exams, I really like that. I like going and putting myself to the test and putting myself under the gun and seeing how I'm gonna perform. It's I like that adrenaline.
What's the adrenaline like when you're in the middle of a blind taste, either for at the advanced level for another competition? What, you know, what does that feel like?
You know, it's interesting because, like, when I was in the practical, or sorry, in the tasting this time around, you know, at the master level, having taken a crack at it and obviously not been successful, but, you know, I think when you do theory, it's kind of like, this is just where you're at with it all. And you got to kind of accept that this is the knowledge that you have, and they're going to give you a bunch of questions and you're going to know it or you don't. So there's a kind of an ease in that, kind of knowing that you just have to be where you are. And then the same thing for practical. It's kind of like, okay, well, I kind of know this is make-believe. You know, obviously they're still grading me, but I get to kind of, you know, go out on a limb and do things and say things and improv a little bit. But tasting really felt like I was being, you know, I was exposed, you know. It was like my palate, and I had four masters sitting in front of me, and I really felt for the first time like, wow, like, they're really judging me to see, like, does he have it or does he not, you know. And it's a tremendous amount of pressure, and I think, you know, like, again, like, it's got to be a big part of how you approach these exams is you've got to prepare yourself mentally to be in that room for that 25 minutes, because, you know, you can nail a flight at home wearing your sweater, but when you're there, you know, with a suit on, with, again, four masters staring you down, you start to lose those things that your ability just becomes clouded with that anxiety and that pressure. So I found it tremendously hard. So a lot of the strategy going in next time is that type of preparation, the mental preparation, and trusting myself, and, you know, not letting the wines push me around.
The trust is such, it is such a big one. I my own experience at the diploma was, and I, you know, I'm like, I started to game one flight for a second. And then I realized, no, this is Loire, you asshole. And then went back and I was looking at my notes. I'm like, they were all right there. It was all right there for you, but you suddenly went off in a different direction. I haven't even thought about that, but just the idea of how important it is to trust your own knowledge and experience when you're doing that phase.
100%. 100%. Yeah. You've got to kind of keep your mind blank in a way. You know, it's like, you can't overthink it. You got to let the wines are what they are. I mean, they're clear, classic examples. There's no, they don't put things in there to deceive you. You know, it's like, you've got to let the wine speak to you, and then you've got to, you know, you got to put it in its place and figure out what it is. But that is challenging.
Have you ever, because I've heard stories of at the, you know, at the highest level where the wine was, you know, a New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc. And I was like, no, there's no way they would do that. There's no way they would do that. And then I've heard stories of people crashing and burning because they convinced themselves, I cannot call this Marlborough Sauvignon Blanc. It must be something else.
Yeah, I've seen that before, definitely in my tasting groups, where, you know, you get just a perfect clear-cut example of something. You're like, no, it's too easy. And again, too, like, that's the thing about tasting with a group, is that you start to understand what people are going to bring, and you start to kind of do this detective work in your head of being like, oh, you know, like, I remember he bought that Cote Roti last time, well, he's probably going to bring that again, or whatever it is. So you start to kind of, you know, and again, it's moving you farther away from the wine, and so you talk yourself out of something that's so clear in the glass, you know. And I've done that so many times where I'll be calling something, I'll be like, you know, I think it's this, but the structure is telling me it's this, but I think it's this, you know. And then it's obviously it's wrong, and it's just like, well, why didn't you just listen to what the structure of the wine was, you know. You talk yourself out of it, but yeah, it's definitely something that happens.
You mentioned, and I apologize, your partner's name, Melissa?
Yes, yeah.
Melissa, my girlfriend Amy does not like Sauvignon Blanc. And doesn't have to be from New Zealand, even Bordeaux, even Sancerre, no matter what. And I'm like, that's fine. If you like everything, you love nothing. Totally, totally good with it. Do you and Melissa, do you guys have any fights? And not like real fights, but do you have any like differences of opinion when it comes to wine?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we tend to enjoy the same stuff, obviously. I mean she's happy enough that I share the wines that I'm buying, obviously. Yeah. But I think the big rift between us is sherry. Like, I just love sherry, and she just hates sherry.
It's
like,
so
She won't drink it. Like, you know, I'm bringing home these, like, really, like, amazing examples and putting together, like, these nice food boards that I think are going to go in, and she's just like, nah, I just still hate it. And I'm just like, what? Come on. Like, just try it with the cheese, you know? Try it with the almonds. It's going to be great. And she's like, yeah. no, I'm just never going to like this. And I'm just like, oh, it's too bad, because it's, like, one of the greatest wines in the world.
It really is. Yeah. Everyone listening, go drink sherry. Like, if you're going to talk about price per value, there's nothing. Sherry is number one on the list. We can find our favorite Cote de Rhones or Chiantis or whatever areas you think make great wine for inexpensive prices. Nothing beats sherry. I remember going to this great sherry bar in London, England for my diploma graduation, and I was so excited. And it ended up being her and her twin sister just watching me try different sherries as they were having glasses of dry white wine. God,
that's amazing.
Yeah, no, but that is so true. All right, let's do some recommendations. Before recommendations, I was reading, are you going on or have you been on Wine Alliance so you think you know wine?
I've been invited on the show. Yeah, I haven't done it yet.
Yeah.
So we're going to look at doing a time probably sometime late January or maybe early February. So I get to go on that show, which I think is going to be really fun.
It is. But the problem is there's like for you, it's almost no win. It's like, oh, look at you, award winner. Yeah. Oh, of course you called it right. And then if you get one wrong, you're in a no win situation.
Oh, hey, it's going to be fun. You know,
I just love
tasting wine. And when you don't know something, that's an opportunity to learn, you know, that's every single time. So as long as you approach it that way, you know, you always come out a winner.
No, that's true. And again, everything is about the humility of it all. Okay. So, you're as someone who has worked in service for so long, your recommendation, open-minded couple. So it's not like they're more old world or new world, but just your own taste and palate. Someone wants a good wine that ain't crazy expensive at a restaurant, I guess, under $80 now, because nothing is inexpensive anymore when you go out for dinner. And by the way, I see why. Anyone complaining, restaurants have very small profit margins. No one's getting rich. The wine is there to make money. Unless it's certain steak joints, you know who you are, and you charge way too much for your wine. But let's start with just a good wine that isn't crazy expensive. And you can do producer, region, you know, what you would recommend.
Sure. Yeah. I don't think I'll go so far as to just go producer. The first thing I'll say just as a broad stroke is that, you know, just I think there's a lot of wine regions now that are emerging on the market that are just such tremendous value that are flying under the radar, but are just kind of coming into their stride. You know, if you look to places like Croatia or, you know, Eastern Europe, there's some really great value wines there. You know, there's strange names of grapes, but I just, you know, at that price point, take a risk, you know, like sub $80 on a list, like ask the sommelier, like, hey, like, what do you think is exciting? You know, like what's interesting for you, and then take a gamble on it, even if it's something that you haven't heard about before. But as you know, something that I think is really exciting for me right now in terms of you know, that kind of price point value, I think there's been a real kind of shift in the style of Malbec from Argentina. And it's strange that, like, you know, like, I normally don't talk a lot about, I tend to drink a lot of old world wines, but I've just seen a real kind of change. You know, I think before, you know, it used to have this real kind of, you know, American sensibility in the sense that the wines are, you know, big and full and full bodied and, you know, using new oak and things. And I think now that they're really starting to find their own identity in terms of these high elevation wines with, you know, concrete egg aging and, you know, a little bit more restraint in the vineyard in terms of ripeness. And these wines have these profound floral and spicy notes. And on the palate, just supple texture, really beautiful. And a lot of them are, you know, if you were to buy them off the shelf at retail, a lot of them are, you know, under $30. Most of them are in around $20. And I've just had this, you know, this strange thing where I've just been so, you know, so keen on these wines. I just think that they're really showing a tremendous value and just absolutely delicious to drink and really approachable for anybody, you know, and just really delicious. Yeah.
The other question is going to be, couple is out for their anniversary. What's your anniversary night wine? But before that, are you seeing more of this at Don Alfonso, at other places, that there's been a bit of a shift away from you know, I'm sorry to use just the stereotype, and Robert Parker has done a lot of good in the business. He's an easy villain. He's an easy villain. But have you seen any more of a shift away from the Parkerization, big extracted wines?
Yeah, 100%. I think there's a new generation of winemakers that, you know, want to do different things, but there's just so much more focus now on transparency and terroir. You know, people really want a sense of place in their wines, and I think that that's leading to wines that are made in a way that the winemaker doesn't have such a heavy hand in terms of how they drink or what the style is. And I think this is, again, to come back to the Malbec thing, I think this is what's kind of happening there. It's that, like, you know, the winemaker is kind of getting out of the way a little bit and saying, like, how does this place really express itself? So, you know, just as a general thing, I think there certainly is a shift away from that big, rich, opulent, oaky style that, you know, tended to be popularized by Parker. You know, I think people are starting to move away from that style. And I see it more and more, both in terms of, you know, what the consumer wants and then also what winemakers are making.
So a couple's going out, this is a big anniversary, they're going to spend $300 on a bottle of wine, which is going to still keep you away from a lot of the Burgundies and Bordeaux of the world. That's just the reality. And as a professional uncle who doesn't spend money on much, you know, I'd certainly, you know, reach for a little bit higher. But anniversary wine, what would you recommend?
Well, you know, I think kind of the impulse is to always, you know, go for champagne. But what I like about, you know, celebrating something like an anniversary is that you're marking a date and time, you know, and wine inherently does that. Wine is a vintage product, you know, it shows a year. And I always try to encourage people to explore wines that have a little bit of age to them. You know, I think it's interesting and not a lot of people have access to those things. So, you know, exploring wines that are into their secondary or tertiary phases can be really unique and memorable for people, and that can further kind of, you know, put an imprint and an importance on a certain date, you know. So I would look to something that, you know, has a little bit of age. And just kind of off the top of my head, something that really surprised me recently that wasn't crazy expensive was a 1988 Lungarotti Rubesco from Umbria, which has, you know, Sangiovese-based wine. And it's, you know, on release, maybe $50-$60. And we were fortunate enough to take some at auction at a great price. And I think we had it on the list for around $300, you know, with a wine with, you know, over 30 years age on it. And, you know, you don't know how it's going to drink because, you know, it's not at the top flight level of Bordeaux, but whoever had cellared them well. And when we popped the cork on that thing, I mean, it was just singing. It was amazing. You know, it had really just reached its apex, and it was such a brilliant wine, you know. And that's the kind of thing that, you know, when you hit that moment, if someone's out for that special night and that's an anniversary and they happen to be married maybe on that day or whatever, I mean, you get a moment like that, I mean, that is really tremendous. It's you know, it's special.
What goes into making, and not everything, but just making a Michelin star restaurant? If you could point to one or two things about, okay, you know why place A is Michelin star and place B might be a great, wonderful, great restaurant, but it's not Michelin. What's one or two things that you would say separates one from the other?
Well, I think a lot of it comes down to precision. You know, like precision, obviously, with the food and consistency with the food. Creativity plays a big part of it as well. You know, people want to see, you know, creative expressions of cuisine at the highest level. But a lot of it for me in terms of that Michelin star comes down to, you know, precision, but with humility. It's like nothing has to be over the top, but everything has to be precise, right from the service. The way that you place a knife has to be consistent across all the staff members there. The training that goes into systems in the restaurant has to be extremely important. The way that people move in the restaurant, the pathways through the restaurant, it has to look and feel like it's choreographed. And I think when you do that, like, it's that kind of attention to detail that really brings it to the next level. And perseverance, like, you know, I have to say that, like, you know, the vision that Nick, who's the president and CEO of Liberty Entertainment, Nick DiNato, the kind of the vision that he had for that restaurant, and the perseverance and the amount of resources he put into that vision and the amount of trust that he put into the people leading that project was incredible. And his vision for it, I mean, it took just a tremendous amount of work, but we really towed the line on it. We said, you know, this is what we're going to do. We're going to bring a world-class restaurant to Toronto. And that's really what the vision was from the beginning. That was his vision. It wasn't to have, you know, the best restaurant in Toronto. It wasn't to have the best restaurant in Canada. It was, you know, we need to make this one of the best restaurants in the world, and we need to approach it that way. And I think when you look at it, all the restaurants of the world, whether no matter what type of cuisine that they're serving, if they have that Michelin star, I think something that's consistent across all of them is that kind of precision and execution in terms of the systems of the restaurant, the quality of the food, and the level of hospitality that's executed there in the restaurant. I think it has to be the center stone of what you're doing to achieve that type of accreditation.
I love that. Precision and humility. All right, we'll end this soon. How is it easy for you, Justin, sometimes when you're at home, just to have a glass of wine without going through the grid?
Yeah, so I mean, it's hard not to think about wine, to be honest. But you know what? When I'm with a bottle that I'm very familiar with, and I've already analyzed it a million times, and it's one of my go-to things that I just always have in the cellar. Yeah, there's a great kind of breath of fresh air to not have to overanalyze it. It's always really great.
What is your go-to right now beyond surprisingly fresh Argentinian Malbec?
Yeah, you know, right now, in this exact moment, I'm drinking, strangely enough, two wines that I've bought a lot of. I'm drinking a Pinot Noir from Baden, which comes in at like $19.95, and it's just super delicious, like pretty complex for the quality level, but just like so easy to drink and just really, really tasty. And then the other one that I'm drinking is kind of a little bit off the beaten path. It's a Syrah blend from Lebanon, from Chateau Cassara. And again, it's like, you know, just over $20, I think. And, it just drinks so well. I mean, it's like, it's so interesting because it has like this real beautiful richness and texture and just really reminds me of like North Rhone Syrah, even though it's a blend. I mean, it's so good. And that's, I think, you know, when I was saying before, you know, explore those outlying regions, you know, it's really important. Those guys are really working hard to get into our market. And a lot of times that stuff's undervalued. Compared to other producers with more marketing money and things like that. It's like, you know, look to those wines and you can find really, really great stuff. So that's what I'm drinking right now. And then all the time, you know, I like wines from Italy. Vino Nobili di Montepulciano, I think, just really always over delivers for the price point.
Yep.
I think, you know, looking to Longhe Nebbiolos when you want a Barolo, you know, looking to Gattinara when you want a Barolo, like again, those fringe kind of areas, often they do the wines just as good and approachable younger. So that's often what you'll see me drinking. And then, you know, some Pinot Noir, but not all the time because I like Burgundy and, you know, that's not an everyday thing.
Kind of hard. Yeah. And by the way, anyone out there that's successful and wealthy enough to everyday high-end Pinot, good for you. And also, I hate you. But no, still good for you. So when is the best Canadian Somme competition? When is that? When do you compete?
I don't know if they've actually set in the date specifically, but I know it will be this coming year, so 2023 in Halifax. But I think most likely in the fall, but they haven't given me the exact date yet. But I know the last one was 2021, I believe. So they normally do it every 2 years. So should be this year coming.
Justin, thank you so much for doing this. And again, congrats. Like, I always love hearing people's success stories. I even more like hearing people's success stories when you know the amount of work that goes into it. We talked about it a bit earlier, but it's good that there is some tangible results that are coming your way that are well-deserved. So congrats. And again, everyone out there, go to Don Alfonso when you can. Check out wine competitions on YouTube. They're fascinating to watch, old ones or new ones. So again, Justin, thanks for taking the time to be part of this podcast today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Stitcher, Spotify, iTunes, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.